Hello and welcome to Your Call. The latest news from Antarctica is not good. Some might even say it's a little scary. A crack, literally a crack, is growing in the continent's fourth largest ice shelf. In fact, it's only about 8 miles from breaking off a piece of ice the size of the state of Delaware. If it happened, that could create one of the largest icebergs ever recorded. And that may sound dramatic, but apparently glaciologists say this break would not necessarily contribute to sea level rise. But what really is important is what impact that could have on the glaciers behind it, because experts do know that melting glaciers do directly impact sea level. All of this, of course, is related to a warming climate in general, which affects much more than just the ice in Antarctica. But the latest developments on the seventh continent could possibly help us understand more about our planet in general and the urgency of stabilizing the climate. So we're going to talk today about Antarctica. And joining us to help us understand Antarctica as a place and also what's happening to it right now are Helen Amanda Fricker. She is professor of geophysics at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography at UC San Diego. Her research focuses on ice sheets in Antarctica and Greenland and their role in the climate system as a whole. She uses a combination of satellite radar and laser altimetry, as well as other remote sensing data, to try to understand the ice sheet and the processes that they've gone through over millennia. Professor Fricker is widely recognized for her discovery of anti-subglacial lakes, and she's also shown that these lakes form what are called dynamic hydrologic systems, where one lake can drain into another in a very short period of time. And she's going to tell us exactly why that's important. Helen joins us on the phone from San Diego. Thank you for being here.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Yes, indeed. And Christina Mittermeier. She's a photographer, writer, and conservationist. She uses her camera to document the intersection of nature and humans. Christina is the founder and former president of the prestigious International League of Conservation Photographers. That's a consortium of some of the best photographers on the planet, and they are actively working for conservation. She is also the co-founder and executive director of Sea Legacy. Christina and her partner, Paul Nicklin, recently went to Antarctica. They documented the changing landscape there, and Christina's also with us. Hi, Christina.
Hey, how are you doing? Thanks
Great.
For having me.
Yep. And we are so happy to have Robinson Meyer. He's an environment and technology reporter for The Atlantic Magazine. He's been writing about climate change. Back in April, he published an article about the hydrology of Antarctica. It's got a very clever title, Antarctic Scientists Go Chasing Waterfalls and Discover Rivers and Lakes They're Unused to. So Robinson joins us from The Atlantic offices in Washington, D.C. Welcome, Robinson.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Yes, indeed. It's so good to have people who can talk specifically about Antarctica, because it is such a mysterious place. Christina, let's talk with you first. It's a place not many people in the world have visited. So can you just start by painting us a picture of the landscape there? What did you see and photograph when you were there most recently? And what really struck you?
I was in Antarctica the entire month of February. We were on an expedition vessel on assignment for National Geographic magazine, and I was there with a team of filmmakers and photographers. And Antarctica, it's not the first time I've been. It's a majestic landscape, and as one of the most remote places in the world, is just an artist's paradise. It's just beautiful. But I did notice changes, things that I hadn't seen in previous expeditions. And the most interesting one was the change of the regime from one of snow to one of rain. Of the 28 days that we were there, it snowed only twice, and it rained almost every day. And what happens when it rains is that, of course, the ice that's sitting on the ground melts a lot faster, almost 10 inches a day, we were told. And the animals, like baby penguins that have all these fluffy coat of feathers, get wet, and they get muddy, and then they get cold, and they die. So that was the most dramatic visible change that we saw, but also a lot of diminishing sea ice and a lot of melting icebergs. closer to the land, out in the open water, we saw very, very little ice. So it's changing rapidly.
And over what time period from, say, your first visit there, what is the passage of time?
Well, the first time I visited Antarctica was in 2010, and so I don't have the long-range view. But even in these short 6 years, it's changed dramatically. You see a lot more land where it used to be covered with ice or snow, and you see a lot more green. The first time I went to Antarctica, and I didn't see any plants, and now you see, you know, lichens and mosses growing on the rocks. It's becoming a green continent.
And that in just a span of 7 years has got to be a major concern for an observer like yourself. And Helen, you've also spent time there. What are your observations?
So I have actually only been to Antarctica once, and that was about 17 years ago now. And so I don't have the near-term perspective, but I don't think that we can really say that it's totally turning into a green continent. I mean, the whole continent is covered in an ice sheet that's on average 2 kilometers thick. So that's actually maybe an impression of one area that's been visited, but I use remote sensing data to look at the entire continent, and I can definitely assure you that the entire continent is still covered with a thick ice sheet.
I was reading in one article where it indicated that it is thinning, however, yes? The ice sheet?
Yes, so there are some parts of the ice sheet, especially around the edges, and especially the parts that are in contact with the ocean, where we are seeing some thinning trends. That's true.
And water, and the sight of water where there should be ice, is a real concern. Robinson Meyer, you wrote about the hydrological, and that's a big word for water, and finding something like 700 streams and ponds and waterfalls. Were any of them where they shouldn't be or where they weren't before?
In many cases, I think we don't know. Now, Helen will know better, but I think the thing about Antarctica is that we just don't have great maps of it. It was only really mapped for the first time and photographed for the first time in 1957 and 1958 when American and Soviet and various other international scientists came together to research Antarctica and the whole global system. So what I wrote about recently, just last month, was the first survey of water in Antarctica. And because our records only go back so far, we know that many of those lakes have been there or those streams have been there for the past 60 years. There's one waterfall, actually, that the researchers wrote about that's been there over 100 years because we have records of it in the earliest explorer records. But I think the thing that was really surprising about that research was that we don't expect there to be this whole system of flowing water on the surface of Antarctica, or at least I didn't, and I think some researchers didn't. And to find that it was there and that in some cases it even seemed to stabilize the removal of water from the ice was really surprising. I think we don't quite know yet how much that hydrological system is changing as the whole continent warms.
There is a pretty spectacular photograph in your April 19th article in The Atlantic of a waterfall. And frankly, I don't consider waterfalls to be something I would expect to even see on the continent because we associate it with being all just pretty much a frozen tundra. So was it a shock to see something that spectacular in the way of a waterfall there?
It was. In fact, it was a shock for the researcher, Robin Bell, who's at Columbia. Basically, she said that there was a friend who went to Antarctica and happened to fly over the waterfall and took a picture of it with her iPhone and then showed it to her later. And it was just completely shocking to see this enormous waterfall. If you go look at the picture, I mean, it looks... It's not quite Niagara-like, but the volume of water going over the waterfall is equal to the Potomac. So it's a major river's worth of water, evacuating off this ice shelf. I think the thing that was also really surprising about the waterfall is it seems like that waterfall has been there over a century. The explorers, there's records from 1912 of explorers noting that they could hear the sound of rushing water nearby, and they weren't sure where it was coming from. And what was even more surprising is that the waterfall seemed to be helping that ice shelf be stable, that it was removing water really quickly, and that was keeping water from seeping down and disintegrating and destabilizing the ice shelf. And so the surprising thing is that it seems like we can get these big water features on, you know, a plane of ice, and they can actually help the ice be stable. And we don't quite understand, is my understanding at least, we don't fully understand that whole hydrological interplay yet, that whole exchange.
Helen Fricker, as a professor of geophysics, you use the possibly the most high-tech research materials. And so what are you finding in your research as it regards what's happening in Antarctica?
So we most of our research lately has focused on using an instrument called an altimeter, which basically measures the height of the ice. It's a pretty simple measurement, actually. It just measures how long it takes for a microwave or laser to get from a satellite to the ground and back again. And by doing that, it can actually measure the elevation or the height of the ice. And because the ice is floating, you can actually turn that into a thickness measurement. And if you do that over time and keep repeating and coming back and measuring the same thing over time, and in this case, we've actually got 23 years of data now from four different missions. And we patch them all together, and we get a time series, and we can see how these ice shelves, how the thickness of these ice shelves is changing. And what we see is there is a lot of interannual and seasonal variability in the thickness, and what we are starting to do is link those patterns to atmospheric and oceanic patterns. So we can actually understand the mechanisms that are driving the changes in Antarctica. I do want to say, though, that the surface melt pattern was actually not at all surprising to me. We actually mapped surface melt streams on the Amory Ice Shelf in 1998. I mean, they exist. It's a very large part of the sort of mass balance of the ice sheet, and it might be surprising to some people, but we do see a lot of surface melt in Antarctica in the summer. That's just because it's a very large ice sheet with a lot of ice, and some of it melts. But most of it doesn't melt, so that's the thing. So we're just seeing, this gives you an idea how large Antarctica is, when a large waterfall like that does nothing really to the overall mass balance of the ice sheet, because it's huge.
Well, if we can define the terms for a layperson listening, the difference between, say, an ice shelf, an ice sheet, and a glacier, is there a difference?
Yes. Yeah, so the ice sheet is the thick piece of ice that's sitting on top. The whole thing is called the ice sheet, and it's sitting on top of bedrock on the Antarctic continent. Now, the parts of the ice sheet that are floating and in touch with the ocean, they are still part of the ice sheet, but we call them ice shelves, because they are interacting with the ocean. They're floating on the ocean. They're part of the overall ice sheet, but they're sort of a subset of the ice sheet, and these are called the ice shelves. And glaciers are the features on the ice sheet that are flowing like rivers to feed the ice shelves.
Okay. Now that we've defined our terms, I want to try to draw a mental picture of Antarctica again, because it's sort of the seventh continent. It's mysterious, and a lot of us just wonder what's happening there that affects our lives and what it's actually like to be on the ground there. So, Christina, you often photograph native people in the context of nature, but Antarctica is the only continent that never had native humans living there. So can you talk about what the original motivation was for you and your partner, Paul Nicklin, to travel to Antarctica?
Yes, Paul, my partner, he was raised in the Arctic in Baffin Island, and so he's seen throughout his life the changes that have been happening to the Arctic, and he's also worked for 20 years with National Geographic in Antarctica. So when we had the opportunity to do this story for National Geographic, we were actually not focusing so much on climate change, and we were more focused on the creation of marine protected areas along the peninsula, the Antarctic Peninsula, which is the part that's most accessible to tourists. That's where the cruise ships go for people to be able to interact with wildlife like penguins and whales. And it's also where a lot of the krill fishery is happening. But when you think about Antarctica, it's one and a half size the size of the United States. It's enormous, and most of the ice is sitting on land. So, you know, I'm sure Helen can explain much better than I can. And when I hear her speak, it almost makes me a little more comfortable, because I've been really worried about what will happen to the rest of the planet once that ice really starts going. And I worry about places like Vancouver and Victoria. I live here on Vancouver Island, and I've heard that over the next 100 years we'll probably see a sea level rise of 1 meter, and that's a lot of water. So, you know, when I go to Antarctica and I have the opportunity to stand there on the continent with the wildlife, it's hard to imagine, you know, that it's so close to the rest of the world. When you think about countries like Kiribati or the Phoenix Islands already going underwater, or Miami spending billions of dollars building these seawalls, you know, it's happening rapidly.
Not to mention the Bay Area and the potential there. Helen, Christina seems to feel a bit better about and kind of backing away from a panic about this. Is that appropriate? Especially in an article from the New York Times on Friday, I think it was, it says that, quote, ice shelves, which form through the runoff from glaciers, float in water and provide the structural support to the glaciers that rest on land. So, as you explained, when the ice shelf collapses, the glaciers that are behind the ice shelf can start to accelerate toward the ocean, and higher temperatures in that region are apparently hastening the ice shelf's retreat. So if that breaks at the crack, the so-called Larsen C, letter C, it's amazing. A chunk the size of the state of Delaware. I mean, should we be worried, concerned, panicked, sanguine? How should we feel about this?
Okay, so, I mean, there are definitely things to be concerned about regarding Antarctica, but the calving of the iceberg on the Larsen Sea is not one of them. So I didn't really get a chance to explain, but the ice sheet has to lose mass, because it's always gaining mass because snow is falling on the ice sheet over a very large area, and that's the mass being added to Antarctica. Now, it has to lose that mass again to maintain, so that it stays the same size. Otherwise, the ice sheet is going to grow and grow and grow, and there'll be no more water left in the rest of the water system. So it's just the way that the whole ice sheet remains in equilibrium. So there are two ways that the ice sheds the mass that it gains through snowfall. One of them is iceberg calving. This is calving of large icebergs like the one we're about to see on Larsen C. And melting, which we're talking about, the surface melting and also basal melting at the base. These processes have to happen. If they don't happen, then the ice sheet is going to grow and grow. So the Larsen C calving event in and of itself is not an abnormal thing. I mean, it's a normal calving event. We have rifts that are cutting all the way through the thickness of the ice shelf, and they're growing and they're propagating and they're reaching the ice front, and then they're releasing an iceberg. This has gone on in Antarctica forever. I mean, this is a process that occurs in Antarctica. What we don't know is whether the Larsen C is calving at a faster rate than it has been. And the problem we have there is that the calving cycle of an ice shelf is something like 50 years. Mm-hmm. We've only been observing the ice shelf for about 30 years. I think the last time it was mapped was said right at the beginning, the first mapping was in the International Geophysical Year in the 1950s. So if you think about it in those terms, we really haven't been looking at this ice shelf for very long. So it would be a little bit premature, I think, to say that this is a climate signal. We should certainly keep an eye on it. We absolutely should keep an eye on it. But I don't think we can go running and screaming saying that Antarctica's falling apart at Larsen C. Even if it was, Larsen C is only holding back a few centimeters of sea level rise. Those glaciers that feed it, that flow into the ice shelf, they will start to flow faster if the whole ice shelf was to collapse, which we don't know is going to happen. We have no evidence that that will happen. But even if it did, it would only be a few centimeters of sea level. So I wouldn't worry about Larsen C. I would definitely not be concerned about that. There are other parts of Antarctica that I would be concerned about, however.
Well, let me ask you about that, because we're actually going to lose you at the half hour. And Robinson Meyer of The Atlantic, just stand by just for a second, because since we're going to lose Helen and her expertise on this issue, I wanted to find out, I know scientists aren't supposed to be emotional or biased, but there are some things about what you are studying about the disintegration of some parts of that ice shelf. So how does that make you feel, and what message do you think it's important to send to the world about what's happening?
Yeah, so I guess the thing that's hard for people to understand is that Antarctica is so far away, as you've very nicely captured in the first few minutes here. I mean, it's so remote from the rest of... I mean, most people won't get to visit Antarctica because it's so difficult to get to. It's so hostile. I mean, it's very logistically challenging to get down there, and it's just a very, very far away, long way from here. So why would anybody in California care about Antarctica? Well, the reason why they should care is that the ice that's being melted from Antarctica and going into the oceans is contributing to global sea level rise all around the entire planet. So all of the world's oceans are going up in the level. The level is rising because there is an increased mass loss from Antarctica. So I'll just start by saying there are some parts of Antarctica we should be worried about, and they are in the West Antarctic ice sheet, a region called the Amundsen Sea. There are some glaciers there which hold back a lot of ice, a lot of grounded ice, and the ice shelves in front of them are melting, and we are seeing retreat in those areas. And there's another process that's going underway there, which is an instability. So we're definitely very worried about that region. When we talk about Antarctica and losing mass, that's the area that's losing the most mass, and it's making up for everything else.
And am I correct to assume that it's not just the introduction of that massive amount more water, but that it's fresh water being introduced into salt water?
That's right. So, yeah, the ice shelf, because it's been formed by snowfall, and then it's compacted into ice, and then it's flowed down from the ice sheet out towards the edges under gravity, then it's got to be part of the ice shelf and floating. It's still fresh water because it's all essentially just come from snowfall. So most of it is very, very fresh. And, yeah, it's just fresh water being added. There's one other thing I wanted to say about the sea level. In California, along the California coast, the effect of a melting from West Antarctica is amplified, and it's to do with the gravitational and the rotation of the Earth, but basically about 30% more sea level will be felt locally in California than global average.
30% feels like a huge, huge, huge number. 30%. And can you talk specifically about the Bay Area at all?
Yes, so we had a report that came out in April. It's called Rising Seas in California. You can just Google it. And it gives a really nice table of probabilities of what we're going to see in three regions in California. We chose Crescent City in the north, San Francisco, and La Jolla in the south. And so this is probabilities of the sea level reaching a certain... so this is mean sea level. This is local mean sea level reaching a certain value by a certain time. And, I mean, there's a lot of information in here. It's probably better for people who are interested to go and look at the tables themselves. But, I mean, planners can use this information to decide, you know, when to start building seawalls and things like that.
And in some cases, there are folks who say, like, yesterday, right?
Well, I mean, you know, why not prepare? Because it's going to happen. I mean, the thing is about Antarctica is we are not going to stop it from losing mass. It's going to lose mass. It's just a matter of how quickly it's going to lose mass. We're not going to lose all of Antarctica. No way. I mean, that's just not going to happen. But we will lose a small fraction of it. And the fact that all of Antarctica averaged together is 200 feet of sea level rise. That's the whole ice sheet. Even if you lose 1%, that's 2 feet. So that's why we're concerned about this.
Helen Amanda Fricker, professor of geophysics at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography at UC San Diego. So grateful for your insight and expertise, setting the scene and the stage for us to talk about this issue. Thank you so much for joining us for the first half of the program. And we hope that we have an opportunity to revisit it with you.
Thank you for having me on. Thanks
and if you
much.
Would, sure, stay with us if you will. Christina Mittermeier, photographer, writer, and conservationist, is with us, along with Robinson Meyer. He's the environment and technology reporter for The Atlantic Magazine. Antarctic Scientists Go Chasing Waterfalls is the name of his April article. And we're going to come back and talk more Antarctica. Stay with us.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW, local public radio. To take part in today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Toll free. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We always like to hear from new voices. And if you'd prefer to write rather than call, you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment at yourcallradio.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. KLW's media sponsor for An Evening with David Sedaris, the best-selling author, humorist, and NPR contributor, will read from his new book, Theft by Finding, on November 13th at the War Memorial Opera House in San Francisco. Information at davidsedarisontour.com.
Welcome back. For those of you joining us now, I'm Renee Kemp. I'm sitting in today for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. Coming up tomorrow, a conversation with Catherine Jacobson Raymond. She's the author of Crooked, Outwitting the Back Pain Industry and Getting on the Road to Recovery. If you're a back pain sufferer, or if you happen to treat people with back pain, you're going to want to tune in. It's one of those shows where you might have thought you were the only one facing these issues around back pain and all the issues around that, but apparently it's quite common. Raymond is a veteran journalist, and she's had her own struggles with back pain, and it led her to investigate the industry. Really fascinating stuff. And then on Wednesday, what's the right way to do free speech on campus? Should there be safe spaces? Should so-called hate speech be accommodated? What about public safety, free speech zones? Highly politicized and sometimes violent disagreements break out. So how do you write a campus free speech code that keeps the vibrancy and the diversity of a university intact, but also protects faculty and students from violence and hate? We hope you'll join us for that conversation on Wednesday. Today, we're talking Antarctica. And what is the continent like? What's happening to it? A large chunk of one of the ice shelves is only 8 miles from breaking off entirely, and that would create an iceberg the size of Delaware. So how will this impact the planet? You heard from specialist Helen Amanda Fricker, professor of geophysics, and she tried to put it in perspective. A little less panic, but a lot more concern than some of us even knew about. So we're joined by conservation photographer Christina Mittermeier and environmental journalist with The Atlantic, Robinson Meyer. And we'd love to have you join the conversation. What do you want to know about that mysterious seventh continent, Antarctica? If you've traveled there, what was your experience? And what are your questions? What are your concerns about melting ice and glaciers that are in Antarctica and are predicted to affect the climate change and the sea level rise? If you have an idea for us for a show, or if you'd like to join us today, give us a call, 866-798-8255. Robinson, let's go back to you. In your article in April, you went back into some of the historical accounts of the first Antarctic explorers and what they found. I believe it was it 1912? Where the first expedition was, and what did you find about their expedition and the potential changes and the importance of those changes?
Well, I thought this was one of the two papers that included the hydrological survey, and one of the really cool things about it was that it went and exactly as you said, looked at one of the two Antarctic expeditions from the 1911-1912 period. So there was the British one, which was the one that wound up being salient for the study, but then there was the Norwegian one that was led by Roald Amundsen, and they were actually the ones who won the race to the South Pole, and a lot of the British expedition died on that race to the South Pole. But this was another team. They kind of split off from the main bulk of the British team, and they went along West Antarctica and wound up actually also getting lost and being stuck in Antarctica for another winter until eventually they hiked across the ice and made it back to base camp. But as before they got stuck in Antarctica for a winter, they took a long sojourn along the coast and inland and across the ice sheet and getting onto a glacier, and they heard this waterfall, although they didn't know it was a waterfall and they didn't get close enough to actually identify it, but they heard rushing water really close to where we now know this waterfall is. And the cool thing about the study is that the researcher who I was talking about earlier, Robin Bell, went to the Oxford Archive in the United Kingdom, where their notes are kept and their possessions are kept and you know the best records of this expedition are held, and pulled out the diaries from this like side team and looked at them and was able to pull all this information out of them and these accounts of the hydrology they observed and also that they heard this waterfall that hadn't been noted before. It was a cool moment of science that is not just, you know, taking really expensive, awesome instruments out into the field or in orbit and pointing them at Earth systems that we want to know about and then, you know, looking carefully at the data they tell us. It was a cool example of, like, science as a detective project, science as, you know, observing the kind of bulk of evidence we have from the Earth system across time and that has been left in different kinds of archives and bringing it together to a common thesis. So that was the cool reason that they brought this 1912 expedition into that survey, mm-hmm. into that that paper. But I think, you know, otherwise there's other researchers who still use that some of that 1912 data as well.
And Christina, how about you? Connecting the dots over time is part of what you do as a conservation photographer and photojournalist, yes?
Yes. I mean, for me, I not just travel to Antarctica. I've been photographing in over 100 countries. And so seeing sea levels already rising in places like Bangladesh, where salt water is, you know, now entering fields where people used to grow food, and in places like Kiribati, where the government is trying to, you know, evacuate the entire population to other places because the country will go underwater. I was just in Greenland, and the Inuit fishermen there were finding fish that they'd never seen before, and this fish were European cod that was, you know, had traveled now so much further because the water is so much warmer. You start connecting all these dots, you know, and I do think there's reason for panic, especially when the government of the United States and Canada are being so casual about reducing emissions and, you know, really implementing steps to curb what's happening.
Well, your group Sea Legacy, your mission is to spread the word about disappearing animals and environments and the vulnerable seaside communities that rely on those things. Can you just talk a bit about what you and your partner, Paul Nicklin, set out to do with Sea Legacy? You said that you're like Jacques Cousteau 2.0, yes?
Yes, you know, I think that in the past 30, 40, 50 years, we've invested a lot of funds on science, trying to understand what's happening to our planet. But you've heard scientists like Amanda, even 10 years ago, scientists were so cautious about, you know, saying with certainty that the climate is changing because they need to have all the data in before they make such a statement. Whereas we're storytellers. We're out there documenting using our camera, using visual storytelling for which humans are hardwired. To, you know, pass the oral history of our planet, to get people interested in this conversation and to, you know, we need citizens to put pressure on our governments to do what's best for all of us. And so Sea Legacy, what we do is we take photographs, we make films, we partner with conservation groups around the world to empower them with these materials for storytelling. And we ourselves are out there giving lectures, speaking, working with magazines like National Geographic, newspapers, radio shows like yours, to share the story, to tell the world what we're seeing.
I know one of the most impressive things is when photographers are able to use time lapse. So have you been able to actually take photographs and go back to the same areas and photograph them over time to show those changes?
You know, not myself, but photographers that I work with, for example, Jane Balog, he's a photographer with the International League of Conservation Photographers. He put something like 40 cameras in remote glaciers around the world, and he created time lapses that are irrefutable proof of how rapidly glaciers around the world, including Antarctica, are shedding ice onto the ocean.
Robinson, speaking of over time, that's one of the issues that you discussed in your Atlantic article. You write that in 2002, a 12,000-year-old ice shelf called Larsen B disintegrated in less than 6 months after large ponds of meltwater formed on the surface. The researchers are projecting that future ice shelves would meet a similar fate. So do you have concerns just based on the research you've done about the issue over time, about how there may be an acceleration that's happening in terms of millennials much, much faster than you would have expected?
I mean, yes. I mean, I think, you know, first of all, the question of time is like so key to how we talk about climate change and think about climate change, because there is a lot of natural climate change, and you know, Antarctica used to be millions of years ago was a swampy, you know, wet, rainy place. Although it was much higher at that point, latitude wise. So I think the problem of climate change, right, is that this is the fastest the climate has changed, as far as we understand it, in the past 65 million years. And so we do see these kinds of shocking breakdowns in the natural system, like Larsen B disintegrating, you know, really, really fast. I think the other, you know, interesting thing about Larsen B was, first of all, it actually just came a few weeks after the U.S. left the Kyoto Protocol. And so there's been this major action on the Larsen ice shelf kind of every time the U.S. leaves a major climate agreement or treaty. But the Larsen B shelf, which was right next to Larsen C, I believe, didn't do what Larsen C is doing. So Larsen C is going to calve. It's going to release this enormous iceberg into the Southern Ocean.
Define calve a little bit. Just
yeah, so calve is just it's what glaciers in Greenland do. It's what, you know, glaciers that you know some of the listeners may have seen, you know, pictures or in person seen in Alaska do. It's when a giant chunk of ice breaks off either an ice sheet or a glacier and floats away into the sea as an iceberg. Mm. And it is very loud as it happens. Mm. And that, so Larsen C will calve, it will break off. It will be a big iceberg and then presumably, is my understanding, you know, break into smaller icebergs. But Larsen B didn't do that. Larsen B very quickly just disappeared. We observed these big ponds of water on the surface. They appeared relatively quickly. At the time, I believe it was summer in Antarctica. And then it just went away.
Well, the stories that you're writing about the water actually are perhaps causing scientists to have to recalculate some of their longest-term estimates of sea level rise, right?
Yeah, exactly. So this is one of the big hydrological questions, is that as Helena said earlier, you can, you know, it is normal for meltwater to form on the surface, or at least we now know that it's normal, and we've been observing that for some time. But at the same time, our warning that Larsen B was going to disappear was that we had these big ponds of meltwater that suddenly formed on the surface and then seemed to chew it through. And our models of ice sheets support the idea that meltwater pooled in such a way that disintegrated the ice shelf. I think researching, you know, I've covered climate science for several years now, and one of the big open questions is how fast these big ice sheets are going to go away. And are going to melt. And when you get things like the Larsen C calving, it does cause all the glaciers behind it to move faster and dump more actual water that's more ice that's on a land surface right now into the ocean and increase sea levels. But we also think that it may be possible that between meltwater and rapidly changing ocean circulation, you could have rapid disintegration or really rapid melting in a matter of decades, especially of the Greenland ice shelf on the other side of the world, and possibly of the West Antarctica ice shelf too. And so this question of how fast are the ice shelves going to go away, you know, as Helen said, we're not going to lose them immediately. We're not going to lose them all, but how much we do lose and how fast that happens are really big questions right now.
Christina, you've been to Greenland. Robinson mentioned some of the other areas of concern. Of all of the places that you have studied and visited and photographed, is there something in particular about Antarctica that gives you special concern about what's happening there and the larger ramifications for the planet?
You know, it's Antarctica, yes, but it's all around the world. It's the fact that I've seen some of the kinds of things that we're describing, these large waterfalls. I was last week just in Svalbard, where the Nordaus-Landet Glacier is also spewing water at high rates. Greenland, it's the same, you know, and you see that it's melting from the bottom. So there's these rivers of water that are underneath the ice sheet. And, you know, at the end of the day, to me, the biggest thing is, like everybody said, we don't know enough. And in the face of uncertainty, we should be using the precautionary principle, and we should be doing everything we can to prevent these massive ice sheets everywhere from becoming unstable, from disappearing, really. Whether we lose them tomorrow or in a million years, they really destabilize the climate of our planet. So,
well, both you and Robinson fold in politics and climate change as part of your journalism. So how do these things connect in your mind? More and more, it seems like news events like coral bleaching and big storms and droughts, now the cracking of the ice shelf in Antarctica, it all seems to go back to climate change. But of course, the president just pulled out of the Paris Accord. Robinson, you mentioned the Kyoto Agreement. It's already seeming to unfold that we're making a major shift in our climate policy at what may turn out to be, when we look back on it, a turning point. So can you just weigh in, Christina, and then you, Robinson?
Yeah, you know, the way I see it, and of course, I was born in Mexico, but I'm American. I'm a resident in Canada. When I think about what President Trump is doing, it's very clear that he's just looking out for his own business interest and those of his, you know, allies and friends. These last ditch to exploit as much as possible the last of the fossil fuel era before we transition to a renewable economy. And this is an incredibly dangerous gamble, because he's not only, you know, setting a precedent for the United States, he's also allowing other leaders like Justin Trudeau to now delay action on methane, for example, or on the tar sands. Even though we have these commitments to reduce our emissions here in Canada, we're increasing. And this allows many other countries to just kind of relax because the United States is taking this position. Now, I was in New York last week, and what I sensed from the people, from, you know, global citizens, was this sense of determination that if our governments are not going to do something, corporate interests and individuals, we have to do everything possible to do our share.
Robinson, can you weigh in on that?
Yeah, I think one thing that becomes clear when you look at climate science around the world and what climate scientists are saying is that climate change is going to happen. It is the condition of the 21st century. It's not what we're trying to avoid in the 21st century. And what we're fighting about now is how bad it will be. And the federal government of this country has taken a number of steps in the past, you know, 4 or 5 months that will increase the amount of emissions in the short term, and could possibly throw off technological development that would, you know, increase the amount of emissions in the long term, and that would make climate change much worse. I think the other thing too, we were talking about uncertainty and the uncertainty of when these ice shelves are going to fall apart, when the ice sheets are going to collapse. And I think uncertainty is really one of the most important things to think about with climate change. There's a lot we're certain about. We're really certain about temperatures. We're extremely certain it's anthropogenic. It's human caused.
Okay.
Sorry. Mm-hmm. We're extremely certain that, you know, different kinds of emissions affect it in different ways. We actually still, though, don't know exactly how much carbon we can put in the atmosphere and keep temperatures to a manageable level. And so when we talk about hitting the 2 degrees Celsius of change, that is a probability. And we're more likely to overshoot the probability and make a warmer planet by putting a certain amount of carbon in the atmosphere than we are to undershoot it. And, you know, even when we look at making the 2 degree Celsius goal, which is what we were trying to do with the Paris Agreement, there's more than a 10% chance that we could that we just have the science wrong, or there's systems in the Earth that will kind of be unlocked once the Earth starts heating quickly, and we'll overshoot it and have 6 degrees Celsius or more of warming. And so for me, what I think of is trying to avoid that uncertainty, trying to hedge against that uncertainty, kind of a global insurance policy is what we should be trying to achieve with our climate policy. And right now, that's just not a frame that we put on it. It's not something we're pursuing in our policies. And it's something that we should probably be getting better at much faster.
But let's face it, human beings tend to be about creature comforts, about immediate gratification. And it's difficult to say 100 years from now, or 50 years from now even, there's going to be a crisis that confronts the planet. Christina, can you just talk about the importance of environmental photography and conservation photography, and then you, Robinson, about environmental journalism and conservation, writing about conservation, to try to drive it home to people that this is a current crisis, not a future menace. Christina?
Yes, absolutely. You know, I think about the words of Susan Sontag, the great American writer, who said that the only reason we care about the atrocities of war is because there are photographers there documenting them for us. And what's happening to our planet is no different. So for me, connecting the dots between a massive famine that's happening in Africa with a Syria refugee crisis, which is a climate change crisis, with Antarctica, Larsen C shelf breaking off, connecting the dots with all of those things that are happening independently and are often reported in the news as independent and not related events, that's the job, you know, to make sure that people understand how something that's happening so far away in Antarctica will affect our wallets and will affect our health. And it's not that there's going to be a crisis in 100 years. It's that the last 100 years that humans are able to live on this planet before it gets too hot or too violent are not going to be comfortable. So exactly what Robinson said, we need to hedge our bets. We need to do everything to make sure that we have an insurance policy. And it starts with curbing emissions, with protecting more of our planet, both terrestrially and in marine ecosystems, and, you know, in setting policies that guide all of these activities.
You know, I happen to think, Robinson, that it's not a coincidence that so much of our popular culture now is about this dystopian society, you know, sort of a Mad Max, where the sun is so strong that you can't go out, and that it's kind of signaling, at least maybe to the next generation, that you might not inherit the same planet that your great-grandparents had. So how do you, as Christina said, connect the dots between what's happening today, how we're living today, and what our possibly inevitable future is if we don't make changes?
Yeah, I think I agree, and I think a lot of that dystopian culture is kind of remarking on the fact that right now it seems like we have a lot of big problems, climate change being one of the biggest, and we're not really doing anything about it. We're just kind of assuming that they'll take care of themselves, or that time or economic growth will solve them.
Or that it's not even real in some cases, right?
Or that it's not even real for mm-hmm. some people, yeah. Mm-hmm. I think the thing I would agree with Christine on pushing back on is the idea that this is a crisis 50 or 100 years from now. We look, there's studies that argue fairly persuasively that the Syrian civil war was prompted by a drought that lasted for the entire first decade of the century and caused a lot of farmers to move into cities, which caused social upheaval and eventually led to the conflict in Syria. And when we look at the conflict in Syria, we see all these refugee and migration flows that, you know, led to, first of all, the drowning deaths of many Syrians, and second of all, that completely stressed the reception structures and nonprofits and NGOs that we have set to kind of handle and help refugees in Europe, and that in fact stressed the entire European political system, in that we just had an election in France where the candidates talked about leaving the European Union or leaving NATO, and kind of pulling out of the big post-war structures that we set up for the past 75 years. So that whole, you know, crisis that we're living through now is climate related. It was migration flows prompted by climate change that helped prompt this entire kind of ongoing electoral crisis in the European Union and arguably in the United States. And so I think we should be thinking about climate change from an environmental perspective, and I will keep writing about it that way, but it is a national security issue. Mm-hmm. And until we have – and national security issues are never fun to deal with, and they require a political base, which is like going to push for us to deal with them. But they also require, you know, both parties being committed to make sacrifices and being committed to deal with a threat head on, because they aren't fun to deal with, even if they're relatively easy for such a large economy and such a rich country to deal with in the short term.
Well, just we've got about a minute left, and I want to give you and Christina an opportunity to express your final thoughts and what your next projects are. So, Christina, final thoughts with about 30 seconds. Final thoughts and your next project.
Well, yes, my final thoughts are for my children. I am the mother of three, and I really am going to work as hard as possible to make sure that they have as stable a planet as possible, and I know there's millions of others that are doing their part as well. So I would like to encourage all our listeners to think about how they can improve and reduce their carbon footprint. I am heading back into the Arctic to continue documenting what's happening. We're going to the North Pole by ship, and that is in itself an amazing thing that you're able now to reach the northernmost latitudes, you know, by navigating on the water, where just a few years ago it was impossible because there was so much ice. So, I'm looking forward to continuing this fight.
All right. Thank you. Robinson Meyer, your last thoughts, please. 30 seconds.
Yeah, absolutely. My first thought is actually exactly what I was kind of running on. Climate's a national security issue, and we need to think about it that way, and we need to think about it from a global stability standpoint. And actually, I'm also headed to the Arctic. I'll be in Greenland and Iceland and the Faroe Islands next month, and it'll be my first time above the Arctic Circle, and I'm looking forward to seeing many of these changes firsthand.
It should be extraordinary. Thank you so much. We're going to leave it there. We've been speaking with conservation photographer Christina Mittermeier, environmental journalist Robinson Meyer. Earlier in the program, joined by glaciologist Helen Fricker from the Scripps Institution of Oceanography. Thank you all so much. Coming up tomorrow, a conversation with Catherine Jacobson Raymond, author of Crooked, Outwitting the Back Industry and Getting on the Road to Recovery. You'll want to join us if you've ever been a back pain sufferer. Your call is produced at KALW, and you can listen to past shows or sign up at our podcast. Visit yourcallradio.org. I'm Renee Kempin for Rose Aguilar. This is Your Call.